The general topics for this week will be on health and wholeness. The topic for this morning will be the nature of illness, slant, brokenness. I don't know how you pick up a slant on tape. I'm Fritz Norstedt. Okay? And then first I should introduce myself a bit so you know what you're in for. A lot of people have been coming up and saying, what's your topic? Now, none of those were friends of mine. And my friends all said, I don't suppose you know what you're going to talk about yet. And that's probably the way it's going to be all week. So if you are bothered by that, then there are so many things to do around here. But my chief occupation in life right now is making sawdust. That'll give you some idea. Every once in a while, a duck falls out of a sawdust or a little bowl or something. But mostly it's sawdust, as my wife can well testify, because I not only carry it out in enormous trash bags and only occasionally come out with a duck or a bowl that I've been turning, but I drag it in the house. And she thought that life was coming to a complete end the other morning when she was making the bed and found sawdust in my bed at some time or other and picked out my ears the night before or whatever. I've been coming to Holden for 23 years or something like that now, off and on. 1963 was my first year here. And there's been a gap of 3 years now, during which I've made more sawdust. But it's always just sheer delight, of course, to come. And this year, maybe perhaps a little loneliness, because so many familiar faces are gone, not crossing paths, staff and others that are not here at this particular time. But then there's that always that excitement of meeting new people. And that's reward enough just to get acquainted with new people. The changes in the place have been slight in those years. But the changes in life itself in that span of 23 years have been enormous. And we're going to get into that just a little bit in a little bit. I start out my professional life as a pastor of a church in Iowa. I was called away from that by World War II and spent 4 years in the Navy and 4 years in graduate school in the field of psychology and counseling. My field has been religion and health. I worked as a therapist for a number of years, and then while doing some lecturing at three theological seminaries that were then existing in Minneapolis and St. Paul, they have now all merged pretty much into one, Luther Northwestern. I was on the faculty at Luther for 10, 12 years as a professor in this field, religion and health. And then left there to take up an unusual position in Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago, which is a hospital that was just trying to get born when I first became acquainted with the project. And they'd asked me if I would come to serve as a consultant in setting up mostly their spiritual program and church relationships and things of that nature. And I said no. And they were puzzled by that. And I said it was because I did not believe in church-related hospitals. And they were more puzzled by that and thought it was a disgrace that a pastor and a theological professor should particularly one in the field of religion and health, to say they did not believe in church-related hospitals. My reason for saying it, however, was a serious one. It was because I did not see any significant difference between church-related hospitals and community hospitals. And I couldn't see building another one of these no-difference hospitals and have the name of the church attached to it. Now, that doesn't mean that the church hadn't been important. There was a time historically when very, very high percentage of the health care in this country was delivered by church organizations and denominations. But then the time came when with the growth of modern medicine, when hospital became too expensive, perhaps, for the church. There became other ways of doing things. The Hill-Burton Act of 1946 or somewhere along in there made it possible for any community that needed a hospital to get one if they could organize up for it at all. So the hospitals were being built all over the country, and they were being built largely then by community organizations instead of by church organizations. And they were doing a great job. What puzzled me about, or what bothered me about church-related hospitals is that I didn't think that they were quite keeping up on the changes that were taking place in various branches of knowledge. As these burgeoning, exploding fields of discovery of what makes a human being function and tick were coming into better focus, it seemed that, to me, that one way or another you had to come to a theological base for the operation. And the theological base may be simply stating that it doesn't make any difference, but there's something of theology, I guess, or you've taken a theological position then, even if it's a negative position. The regimens of health care were dictated in almost entirely by non-religious or non-ecclesiastical determinations. And this bothered me a bit also, particularly when there was a new understanding from scientific fields of the unity of man, the essential unity of man, which somehow or another begged more clearly than before for the involvement of the church in the healing processes. We have some theology that fits better with modern science than it did with some other views, older views, even those within the church. Let me explain. The concept of man that divided him so easily into body and mind and soul was not a biblical idea. The biblical idea is quite different. If you can take body and mind and soul, and instead of just using them as words by which you sort of describe aspects or views of the human being, if you start to describe those in terms of its parts, then I think we get into serious trouble. And that's why schools get put on one corner and churches put on another corner and hospitals down the block and nobody talks to each other until recently. There's been almost no communication. There were new biblical studies also that were emphasizing this essential unity and indivisibility of the human being. So that you couldn't simply say, well, this is a physical illness, we'll throw that part over to the doctor, and the doctor functions as though this were a physical, material thing that he's working with. And then you take this brain and you pass that on to school teachers, and unfortunately they got to take their restless bodies along with them and drives the teachers nuts. You know? But you take that and you say, now your job is to to do something with this cortex, this 3/8-inch layer in front of your brain business, that's where you stick. And it's only recently that I think that we paid a great deal of attention to what kind of breakfast a kid gets before he comes and tries to learn something with that undernourished cortex. Or to pay much attention to the fact that his parents may have had a horrible fight that morning. And he's supposed to, while he sees his home and the nest in which he is living and has been born, crumbling, and he's supposed to learn something about algebra or whatever. And we haven't put these things together. And the Bible talks about a human being that is unified, in which there is the aspects of his being, and forgive me now if I keep on lapsing into words like parts. I don't know how to use the language well enough to get away from it, but every once in a while I'll talk about parts, and I don't mean parts. That understood? You all agree with me on that? I mean, just let me do that. If I say parts, you hear something else, aspects or something, but don't hear parts, because I just get trapped. Well, let's take a look now at this part that we call the soul. The part, this soul thing, that's a biblical word. You've heard it many times. We use it in our liturgy, and we use it in our sermons, and we hear it a good deal. To most people, I would think even today, we think of the soul as some fraction of a human being, right? As some part of him. And that's what I'm proposing is exactly not true, even from biblical revelation. Let's start back to that biblical revelation a bit. There was a time when God threw up these great big mountains and separated the sky and the waters and Lake Chelan and all of this stuff in this fantastic process, whatever it was, that we call creation. Until very recently, we've paid little attention to creation, which is another of the problems that has been Lutheran Church. We paid very little attention to creation, which is another one of their problems in relating our faith to our health. And the only evidences that we have had some interest have been through some charismatic things. And when I'm talking about faith and healing, don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about faith healing, the way we usually use those terms. I don't know much of anything about it. And so I'm not going to spend much time talking about faith healing as such. But when God put this human being together in this creation, after separating out the waters and the dry land and the light and the darkness and pushing the mountains up, the Buckskin happened to be my favorite of all mountains over here, particularly in the wintertime. That's the one kind of looking up the valley a bit. And then he said, now let us make man in our image. I think even the pronouns are kind of interesting there. God speaks out of a sort of a plurality, huh? Now there's a mystery in this, of course. We're talking about the mystery of the Trinity. But perhaps one of the meanings of the Trinity is relationship. That here is a God who can't be defined except in terms of community, of relationship, of communication, and wouldn't define himself in other terms. In this big mystery of the Trinity. But he says, now let us make man in our image. And proceeded to do so. Out of the dust of the ground. We came out of the stuff of this creation, out of the very material of the ground. Don't step on the dirt irreverently. I had a group here one October, kind of a young adult class for a while, and I asked everybody to go out and find one cubic yard of Holden and claim it for themselves. And for the 3 weeks or a month or whatever the course took, they were to spend at least an hour in that every day in the one cubic foot or cubic yard. Actually, it took a little bit more than that for some of us. But they were supposed to go there to meditate a bit. But partly I wanted them to sit on the ground, and I wanted them to hold ground, and I wanted them to hold dirt in their hands and to remind themselves that it was out of this dust that we came and were formed. We are not separate from creation. We are very much rooted in creation. And the primitives and some romantic ideas also, when they talk about Mother Earth in some ways that probably are a little bit too romantic, have a hold of some truth that we ought to re-grasp. And that's partly what I was asking them to do when they were sitting in this place and then seeing the flies come through it and wondering what a fly was and maybe watch the ant and marvel at the ant for a bit. I don't know if you remember Zorba, the Greek. Those of you who do remember may remember one day he was walking along with his friend and partner and boss, and they saw, or Zorba saw, stopped cold in his tracks and stared at a peasant with his mule. And the peasant became very much afraid. He said, "Stop that, you're putting the evil eye on." And Zorba just was entranced at what he was seeing. And then the peasant hurried off, scared stiff. And so the buddy says to Zorba, "Zorba, why did you do that?" And Zorba said, "Didn't it strike you, boss?" "Well, what do you mean, strike me?" "Didn't it strike you that there is such a thing as a mule?" And partly what I wanted them to do, sitting in this cubic yard and see an ant come across them, and to be struck by the fact of a fent. You could spend your life studying an ant. I have friends who have spent their lifetime studying the amoeba. You know how small they are. And they still haven't even begun to come to the end of the mystery of that tiny, tiny form of life. Out of this dust we came, out of the stuff of creation. And then we were put together in a peculiar way. When God said, "Let us make man in our image," he formed us out of the dust of this ground, some way or another. I don't happen to believe that it was an act of sculpture or pottery or something. There's something richly symbolic in all of this language. But the important thing is, no matter what the process was, he breathed into our nostrils the breath of life. Remember? There is something here that it's going to be fun to discuss with him someday, huh? To find out what happened when the breath of when God's breath came into us, and what is meant by all that. We stand before a mystery, thank goodness. I'd hate to have that one explained anywhere short of heaven. Because it's not mysteries that destroy, but perhaps are dependent on facts and understandings that we're so hooked on. We're just absolutely obsessed with understanding. And understandings can be helpful in some things, and they can be destructive in others, and they can be cluttering up in for many different ways. But to tune in on the mystery is one of the secrets of living and living healthily. To stand before the mystery, to be caught up in the mystery of God and the mystery of man and the mystery of creation and the mystery of the breath of life breathed into us. that somehow or another made us different from anything else in creation. Remember the end of that statement is, he breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and so man became a living soul, huh? A soul is what we are, not some fraction of us. This is what we became. We became souls. A soul is a word that is used very often in Scripture, not most often, to speak about the wholeness of man and the indivisibility of man. And it was this part that I thought modern hospitals had neglected or not known about, including church hospitals, until the new scientific discoveries start to converge on each other, and they converge at the point, like say from microbiology and physiology and all of these new developing sciences, the better microscopes that can look more deeply down into the tiniest little cell and discover that it's far more complex down there than they ever believed it could possibly be. Psychiatry. So many different fields were exploring man more deeply, and the more deeply they explored, the more their lines of discovery converged on each other and showed an interdependence between the aspects of his being that was absolutely unmistakable. Now, if you include in these aspects ways in which the human can be viewed, if you include in there the factor or the reality of his spirituality, then this is something that is having an effect upon the rest of his life, and which is in turn being affected by the rest of his life. You ever tried to pray with a bellyache? It's hard to do. You ever tried to pray except screaming for help if you're in desperate trouble? It's hard to go through the other kinds of prayer, isn't it? It's hard to think if you are malnourished. We are put together in such a way that there is an inseparable, constant interaction between all aspects of a person's life. Now let me define those. If Descartes, sitting in a steam bath one night, and that's an interesting place for such a thought to come, and he developed, or first enunciated, I guess, this idea of body, mind, and soul in his terms. It was an old Greek idea to begin with. But the three unpluggable, divisible parts that grew out of this, and which as a society we implemented, were terribly distorted. Let me go back to something I said earlier now. The church has paid very little attention to the health of human bodies, except by way of a hospital out there that functioned pretty much like any other hospital functioned. Now, my father was a chaplain in the hospital, and I have grown up with deaconesses, and I have much appreciated these fine and noble people. I'm talking now about the way medicine is practiced, not simply the comforts that may be added out of faith or something as sort of an add-on. Descartes' unpluggable human being, detachable, is a violation of the biblical concept of what a human being is all about. In this inseparable dynamic interaction that's with us from the time we are born until the time we die, and I don't know how much after that. These three parts that Descartes came up with, maybe are not quite enough to describe man. And so in a hospital that I was associated with, we dreamed up two more parts just to confuse the issue a bit. But we then talked about body, and we talked about mind, and we talked about not soul, but we talked about spirit. We talked about relationships, and we talked about emotions. It seemed at least helpful to think of these ways in which the human being may be viewed. Not that man has a body, but that man is physical. Not that man has spirit, but that he is spiritual. Not that man has a mind, but that he is mental and intellectual. Not that he may know somebody, but that he is relational. He is a relational being, and not that this is some part of him. And his emotions, which so much interplay with totality of his life and are so closely related to other aspects, all of these having some effect upon him. Now, let's take an example of how some of it works. Let's say that a man comes up and points a gun at me, right smack between my eyes. If I was just intellectual, I'd say, well, this is interesting. A man has now taken a gun and he's got it pointed right at me, and if he pulls that trigger, I'll be dead. But that's not the way it happens, is it? Something else takes place. My eyes see a gun. That visual image gets thrown up somehow or another into this front part of the brain, and you get an interpretation of it. And when you get that interpretation of it, which I just went through, that's the man pointing a gun at me. If he pulls the trigger, I'm going to be dead. But that's only the beginning of the story, isn't it? Because then something backwashes into another little part. It's probably about that size, and if you take your thumb and put it as far back in your mouth as you can, just before you gag, straight up above that is this little hypothalamic area that probably is the place where emotions pick up their emotion, where they pick up their implementation, and where the whole big process now resulting from this information that came visually and then interpreted by the brain, by the cortex, then it gets dressed up with appropriate emotions. In this case, fear. And as soon as you become afraid, all kinds of things happen. Right away, there are signals that go out in a bunch of different directions. One of them goes right away to your lungs, to your diaphragm. It's a big thing that goes like this when we breathe. And that goes faster right away. You don't have to stop and think, I think I better pump in more air so I got more oxygen because I'm going to need it. You don't have to think about it at all. It just happens because you're afraid. A message went down, get going, buddy, pump, to get much more oxygen into the blood. Same time, another message goes to the heart, and the heart picks up its beat. The pulse rate goes way up, right away, instantaneously. Another signal goes down to the, just above the kidneys, or on riding on top of the kidneys, gland there, adrenal glands, and they squirt out some juice into this now rapidly coursing oxygenated blood. Huh? All this is taking place, not necessarily in the order I'm suggesting. This goes raging through the liver, which is a big storehouse of potential fuel. If you take the sugar stuff that's stored in the liver and you take this oxygenated blood and you combine this sugar and the oxygen, you get the gasoline that the body burns. You get the glycogen. That now you're fueled up, supercharged, to do something about this guy pointing a gun at you. You know, you can do several things, I suppose. You can drop dead of fear, which isn't a good thing to do. You could fight him, You could reason with them, you could run, but you're, at least you're supercharged for action and not for just standing there with a gun pointing at you. I never had a gun, well, yes, once I've had a gun pointed at me, and it was the way I described it. But most of the times that I get supercharged have been for other reasons, and it's a little harder to fight. And the plight of modern man is that as these things take place, it's a little bit harder to find direct action. I have found, I don't think since I was 12 years old have I ever doubled my fist and hit anybody when I have become afraid or angry. And incidentally, the chemistry and the physiology of fear and of anger are identical. Now, let's just say that I'm worried about the bills coming due now at the end of this month, and will my paycheck, which is always 3 days after the first of the month, will it be in, will I come out even on this thing so I can pay up the bills and balance the checkbook? Now, somewhat the same process takes place, but now there's a more chronic thing. This isn't only going to be for an instant or two until the emergency is over, one way or the other, but it's going to be continuing for, what is this, the 26th or 27th or 28th or whatever. It's going to continue at least until the 3rd of September for me. And I'm going to be worrying about it. Well, now, while that's going on, I'm going to have some modified chemistry in my body. And if I have bankrolled a whole bunch of anxieties out of my past that I haven't quite found a way to resolve, so they're stacked up one on top of each other and then pushed down and buried down and repressed into this somewhat unconscious mind, unless somehow or another I have learned that this has happened every month for years, and somehow or another, life goes on. So just experiencing this may teach me, don't get so terribly panicky about all of this, because you've lived through this before and you've learned how to deal with this, and so maybe it isn't going to happen that I'm going to have a big catastrophe on my hands. Or maybe there's some place at which the gospel intrudes into this situation and says, hey, buddy, you remember who made you? Who created you for himself? Who loves you? It isn't all that bad. Relax. Have some kind of calmness down in the middle of this whirling storm in which we all find ourselves. Find that there is an eye into which you can retreat. Sometimes it's done through prayer, and sometimes it's done just done because you've learned to live in a consciousness of God in life. Now there's a lot of difference between the chemistry of a human body that's experiencing that peace of God which passeth all understanding and one that doesn't know anything about it. Once offered by a group of doctors who were quite aware of blood sugar levels in a situation of peace as over against blood sugar levels in situations of fear. I was offered a rather large research grant from these doctors that wanted to prove something on behalf of their own theology. It just happened that my own agenda was such I couldn't go into this study, but it would have been very, very interesting to do, in which they would try directly to measure blood sugar levels after effective prayer with a person facing surgery, for instance, and after. I had doctors in Minneapolis, 5 surgeons, who banded together, Christian surgeons, who said, We know the relationship between fear and the way in which people handle surgery. And we've come to the conclusion, based largely on a study at the University of Minnesota, that showed that there was significantly higher mortality rate on surgery or during surgery with people who had excessive fears as over against those who entered into it with some sort of equanimity and peace. And they said, all right, certainly the Christian faith has an application here that needs to be used. And so they had me on call, and when they found people that they suspected of being excessively fearful of surgery, we'd get together and sit down with the patient and work for time until something like peace came before they did surgery, if the surgery was not an emergency surgery, obviously. If the person bleeding to death, you had to go in there and tie off some vessel, but you're not going to take time even to pray. You just do it. And the doing of it becomes its own form of prayer, obviously. But if there was a time for this, then the patient not only has a less horrible experience going into it, but accepts the anesthetic much better than you would if you're fighting it because you're afraid that maybe you won't come to again and won't live. Now, if the Christian faces surgery, that may be life-threatening surgery, he may be able to take a rather deep, calm breath and say, okay, when it all comes down to the end here, I go into this, I lose consciousness under the anesthetic, which is kind of like dying. I'm completely, I've turned over control completely now to skills and powers outside of myself. And if I live as I expect to, great, I'll celebrate. I'll celebrate the skill of the surgeon. I'll celebrate the all of that huge armamentarium now of modern medicine with its great gadgets and knowledge and substances of one kind or another that are going to contribute to my health and to my recovery. If I die, well, I can say, I guess, Paul, whether I live or die, I die in the Lord, or live in the Lord, or die in the Lord. So the fear can be reduced, provided, as Christians, we have a consciousness of the reality of God and the reality of eternity. Don't ever drag me near surgery if I don't know that I'm going to live forever. Because I don't want to face that. I just don't want it. On the other hand, I guess even get a little excited about dying. That sounds kooky. I think I can get excited about dying. Because, wow! Last night some of us watched Jupiter put on a show for us up there in the saddle. I can remind myself that I ain't seen nothing yet. You've seen some of these pictures they take from space? Well, I don't know where heaven is, whether it's out there or obviously that's a mystery of some kind. All I know is that the view is going to be great. Maybe it'll be a different kind of view entirely. And something that we don't even recognize as view. So what? The Lord who put Buckskin up there and put Jupiter up there can be depended upon to give me some surprises that are most exhilarating and exciting and rewarding. And so sometimes I even get a little impatient for it. Do you ever find yourself getting We're going to talk a little bit about dying someday in this thing. Let me give a couple of little examples. A woman came into the hospital once with a bad coronary. She came into the hospital more dead than alive, fought with dedication and the knowledge and the instruments of modern medicine. And they kept her alive, and the heart was restored to a normal beat again. And they kept her for 3 weeks in a good, modern, sophisticated, state-of-the-art coronary care unit. And they got that heart muscle healing, not healed. And then they said, okay, lady, you're ready to go home. So they sent her home, and she was back about 12 hours later, dead. Dead on arrival. Well, obviously she hadn't been ready to go home. Something was wrong, huh? So we said, what in the world went wrong? How could we possibly have let this person out of the hospital, only to get home and to drop dead? Well, we hadn't done our work. This place had been dedicated to looking into and approaching life from all different sides. This hospital has a staff, for instance, of social workers, 36 master level social workers in that hospital. And obviously, they have to be doing more than what social work services are provided in most hospitals. Otherwise, they'd be the most unemployed bunch in the world. They are actually so busy that they're just driven frantic because they have to check in on these relational aspects of this human being. Remember, we talked about, say, now five sides instead of... So their job is to check on these relational aspects. And the pastors check on the spiritual aspects. And the doctors check on the physical aspects. Psychiatrists check on the emotional aspects, and so on. But by the way, there are 35 pastors, specially trained pastors, all with at least a year beyond their theological work in clinical experience. Most of them, the average is something over 2 years of special training. Three of them are working, for instance, only with the dying, full time. Now, with this woman, we had failed to do the homework. By that I mean literally. Nobody had gone to the home to find out what kind of a home she was in when she had her first coronary. Now, when we did that then, everybody feeling terrible about this, but somehow or another we'd slipped up on it. Then we got an answer that could be the answer to her coronary. Now, granted that there are lots of causes, lots of factors that go, because this is a total person disease, like every disease or problem is a total person problem. You don't have a little finger problem. Try smashing your finger with a hammer sometime and ask if it's a little finger problem. I hurt, huh? It isn't just that little finger. I hurt. If I have a coronary, and I've got one to my credit, I had the coronary. I am sick. Not just my heart, or some fraction of the heart. Well, this woman, when we checked, had her coronary one night at about 1 o'clock, when some plainclothes detectives came to the door and with a search warrant, giving them access to her 12-year-old daughter's room. The mother couldn't understand what in the world was going on. Insisted on calling the police, even though she was confronted by the police, because she couldn't believe anything like this was going on. They said they were searching for drugs. They called the police, and the police, she called the police, and they said, no, these men are there, the warrant is valid, and we're sorry about this, but they'll have to search your room. Well, they found a lot of cocaine and a lot of marijuana in the room. Subsequently, we found that that girl had made $12,000, which she had surreptitiously banked in a savings account the year before, selling heroin and cocaine on the high school parking lot. She was 12 years old. Her influential father, trying to protect the mother, had managed to keep her out of jail and to keep her out of court, except in quiet court cases hearing before the judge, and the judge would say, yes, we understand, well, you do as or you can out of control this. No, we won't let it get into newspapers. So the mother didn't even know anything about what's going on. All of a sudden, she's bombed with the fact that her daughter has been arrested many times on drug charges that she was not informed about. And she did the only decent thing that a person could do, I guess, is to register the shock, and in this case, it turned out in the heart. Now, that was the first time. The second time she got back and found that her daughter, when she did get home, all happy that she could get home, but still kind of dreading it, in this ambivalence that so many patients have when they leave hospitals. It isn't always, oh great, I'm going home today. And so very often a reluctance to go home today, because now you're going back into this real world again, without the supports, without the people gathered around that hold you together, and without the insulation from the realities that you may have had back in that life, whether it's in the house or in your job or where. She got back and found out that her daughter was now in jail in a detention center and was facing a trial on possession of cocaine. And the little girl never used any drugs herself at all. She was just an entrepreneur at the age of 12. When her mother was hit with that and came into sharper focus even than the first time, then she was on the floor again. And by the time the very sophisticated emergency vehicle with its well-trained personnel arrived there, it was too late to do anything about it. They did bring her into the hospital, but she was dead on arrival. Or what did she die of? We did a post-mortem on the whole case, I suppose you'd say, not on the body. But she died of a lot of things. She died of a coronary insufficiency, part of it. She died of a spiritual insufficiency. Nobody in that family had anything that could be called a religious or spiritual reality in their lives. The family lived in a world of plenty of money, plenty of things, plenty of gadgets, and an absolute poverty in all meaning and significance in life. Remember, the whole family was that way. And the little girl was groping to try to find it by selling drugs and building up a bank account. To say that this was the result of coronary disease is a lot of foolishness. It was partly because of some coronary disease. If we identify illness with single factors, diseases, we will continue to fail to heal people. Let me play with some words for a minute. There's no question but what one of the exciting advances of mankind, going all the way back through history, it's hard to find anything quite as exciting or successful as our advances in curative medicine. Brilliant minds, dedicated minds, lots of experience, all put together to make us the most favored age that you could imagine. They can do things today that 10 years ago they wouldn't have dreamed of doing. And certainly 50 years ago wouldn't have thought it would ever be possible. My daughter died of cancer here a while ago, 12 years ago, last week. Almost nobody dies of that particular cancer anymore. She was one of the very last to die, simply because they found very good, almost foolproof way of coming to an early diagnosis and putting it together with one of the miracle chemicals. Very, very few people die of choriocarcinoma anymore. Curative medicine, man, right, what fantastic, exciting stories and accomplishments. But this has led to people living longer, huh? No, we do not live longer. Let's back off that one. That's a mistake and an illusion. We do not live longer. Just more of us live longer. More of us live into the 70s and 80s and 90s because we don't die of other things before that. But we haven't added much to the span of life otherwise. We don't find it because of modern medicine, we're now living to be 160. We still drop off that there's some sort of an automatic deadline in there someplace that sort of sets some limits, fortunately. Who in the world would want to hang around here forever? There are other places to go and things to see and things to do out there. But it's great to be here for a while, and it's even great to be here in good health until you get ready to die. The only thing that bugs me about it, I guess, is at the moment, if you live long enough, you tend to have cancer. And if I could regulate this myself, I would just rather go to the coronary a little bit earlier. So when my skinny brother tells me I've got to take off weight, I have some interesting philosophical discussions about that. At least I'm slanting the odds in favor of a coronary instead of the opposite. Now, don't. Hey, take that off the tape. No, it probably hasn't. But the problems of getting ourselves geared to a different understanding of what illness is serious, and I think the church has something to say at this point. It has something to say because it has something, some knowledge, some insights, some peculiar insights into the nature of man. And we ought to be able to put man together a little bit better in our concepts and in the practices, particularly those I'm thinking of now in health care. If we could find a way to meet these other needs, the way modern medicine has met the, what I might call the purely physical needs, then perhaps we could move from curing people to healing people. I mean, now I'm playing with words. I'm using healing as something that relates to the total person and not to some fraction of his being, some organ, for instance. play the words down a bit. Health and wholeness come out of the same kind of roots, don't they? Human beings are fragmented, are compartmentalized, we're torn apart between this tendency to divide and to specialize. And somehow or another we have to find ways to bring these magnificent specialties into concert in the way in which we deal with human beings. The most profound healings, I think, will be seen in the future to take place when we have been able to heal persons and therefore heal as parts. And not simply heal parts and return a fraction, distorted, fractured being out into society again. That incident of that woman was not an atypical one, surely. The studies that have been done out of this particular hospital and the medical school of which it is a part have indicated that there is a lower rate of hospitalization, return hospitalization, after this kind of treatment than there is if you ignore these things. In those cases within that hospital, because it's far too cumbersome and expensive to, at this point in history, to do this for every patient that comes into the hospital. But for this has been applied, where a team has been working in concert together to explore the home and the relational environment, the spiritual life and commitments and base with the individual, his emotional well-being or lack of it, where these have been the focus of the healing process, then a person has been healed and there is less tendency to develop other illnesses, specific things that will return it. At least the evidence is pointing rather strongly in that direction, and so far incomplete research, but very exciting studies. The medical school, University of Illinois, Abraham Lincoln School of Medicine, chose this hospital as a part of a new experiment in the way in which medical education is taking place, because of this kind of a philosophy and approach to medical care and to health care. The students were horribly confused in the beginnings of this, and then the last year that I was at the hospital, the dean of the medical school said that 2/3 of the applicants expressing their choice of where their training was going to be taking place, chose Lutheran General Hospital as their first choice, and it was because of this broader approach to health care. The University of Michigan asked us to come and set up the same kind of a hospital, same kind of program on their campus. But the church-state issue got in the way on that one, because it would have been very cumbersome. And they thought they could pull this thing through, but we decided not to even approach it because it was obviously going to fail by the first lawsuit that was brought against the thing. Because the church-state confusion there was very clear. They wanted to provide a hospital on their campus for us, but it would come completely under our jurisdiction as far as the operation of the hospital was concerned and the training of medical students in the hospital. So we backed out of that one, but it's certainly going strong with the University of Illinois and the Abraham Lincoln School of Medicine. The changes in modern life are contributing to an increased anxiety. We're more tense. If you look back say, 50 years now, a little bit more, in my lifetime, I saw the first airplane ever to land in and I'm not ancient, I'm 73 years old. But in that lifetime, I have seen the first airplane ever to land in Central Iowa, in Iowa. It was a World War I Jenny that came in just to show us what an airplane was, operating out of a cornfield. The Concorde landed in Seattle here 6-8 months ago with a load of wine. Do you happen to remember that? That thing flew at speeds beyond sound. Fantastic. It only took them a few hours to get from Paris into Seattle. And that Concorde, the only time Seattle's allowed one of the things to land there. My left ear heard the first radio that was ever heard in Red Wing, Minnesota. The first radio signal. My dad and my brother had built this contraption. It spread out over a whole bedroom, hardly leaving room for a bed. And the thing wasn't working. My dad had to go up to church to direct a choir at night, Thursday evening or Friday evening, or whenever the choir met. And standing there with his hands up like this when I dashed through the door to tell him that I had just heard, because my brother had found the loose connection that solved the problem. Dad had left him, and when he went up to church and said, "Now, Lyle, you go over every connection, because that diagram is right, this thing's got to work." He'd heard them up in Minneapolis, but nobody had ever had one in Red Wing. He checked it and found the loose connection. And he had this thing on my ear. It was a headset thing, you know, but only one thing. I suppose, think that was for economic reasons. And I could hear some crackling, and then I heard some music, and then somebody saying this was KDKA Pittsburgh. And it was like the millennium. What in the world taking place? I can hear somebody talking in Pittsburgh. Well, penicillin was unknown. Just think of all the things we didn't know 50 years or that are developed. Computers, the profits for a lot of this were the cartoonists or the comic strip writers. It used to be the poets, remember? It was the poets who were the prophets. And then through the 20s and 30s and 40s, it was the comic strip.